Chapter 32. Lebanon. Stark, raving mad. A chauffeur drove me from the Beirut airport to the luxurious Venetian Intercontinental. A young bellman greeted me enthusiastically, took my bag, and ushered me into the lobby. As I turned from the reservation desk, I crashed into another man. I stepped back and apologized, shocked by a familiar face that gave me a leering smile and the unforgettable voice that muttered, "It's okay." The bellman grabbed my arm and hustled me away, then stopped.
"Yes, Marlon Brando is your neighbor tonight," he said.
He shook his head and added,
"He's got a terrible temper. Please don't ask for his autograph."
I could not help gawking as we headed for the elevator. Brando looked older than the last time I had seen him in a movie, but there was no doubt that he was indeed the actor I had long admired for his performances in On the Waterfront and A Streetcar Named Desire. I had read about his most recent film, Burn, a performance he claimed was his best yet. I took it as a good omen that I had encountered, literally, the great actor and infamous rebel on this, my first trip to the Middle East. Years later, when I finally saw Burn, I was deeply amused by the irony. Brando played the precursor of an EHM in this groundbreaking film about empire building. The next morning, Charlie Illingworth's friend picked me up in his car. He introduced himself as Smiley, although I could never quite figure out why, since he was not by nature a jovial person, and seldom exhibited the expression for which he apparently was named. As it turned out, he did not work for the embassy, but rather for the United States Agency for International Development. He had spent his entire professional life with USAID, and now, approaching retirement, had requested Lebanon as his final assignment. He had grown up there, the son of missionaries, and had wanted to retire to the land of his youth. Now, however, he had changed his mind. "Too much turmoil," he told me as we drove along a spectacular stretch of the Mediterranean. "These damn Muslims are getting out of hand. Simply can't be trusted. No matter what the deal we strike with them, they never keep their end of it." I asked him to show me some of the Palestinian refugee camps I had heard so much about. At first reluctant, he eventually agreed to drive me by one of them. Despite my recent experiences in Indonesia, I was shocked by the poverty and degradation. The camp consisted of a mass of hovels crowded together and surrounded by fences. I wondered aloud how the people living there maintained their sanity.
"They don't," Smiley assured me. "They're stark raving mad, the lot of them."
I asked him about water, sewage, and other basic services. He guffawed.
"All you have to do is open the window and take a whiff to know that sanitation ain't in their vocabulary."
He gave me the closest thing I'd seen to a grin and pointed.
"Another planet from where you and I live."
His eyes returned to the road ahead.
"These people are pigs.
Consider this.
A little over a year ago, the Lebanese government and the PLO signed something called the Cairo Agreement. It grants residency, labor rights, and autonomy to Palestinians. Since then, the Lebanese government's been trying to clean things up." He sighed. "But, typical of Arab Muslims, these Palestinians just can't accept a good thing. The PLO stepped up its attacks and is striking deals with the Lebanese communists, really pissing off the government here, as well as yours truly, us guys from the good old US of A. There's going to be retaliation, no question about it. These Arabs are about to pay the price for their insanity."
That day disturbed me deeply. As a Peace Corps volunteer in the Ecuadorian jungle, I had lived like a campesino and had been disgusted by the elegant lives of U.S. Embassy and U.S. aid people, by their houses, cars, clothes, and the obvious gap between them and the majority of Ecuadorians. But I had never heard any of them talk like Smiley. I was stunned by his bitterness and overt prejudices, and by his willingness to share them with a stranger like me. He derided Islam, contrasting what he referred to as a sword-wielding prophet with Christianity's Prince of Peace. I was tempted to mention the role the Catholic Church has played in fomenting wars,
to compare the Arab Saladin's compassion for captured crusaders with the slaughter of Muslim prisoners by European knights. However, I was intimidated by him. I was the new guy on the block. I held my tongue. I tried to write his diatribes off as acrimony. I suppose that at this point in his life he did not care what I or anyone else thought about him. Retirement was just around the corner. The place he had dreamed about living in had disappointed him. Like many bitter people, he was taking his frustrations out on the nearest, most defenseless target, the Palestinians. Smiley dropped me off at my hotel. I offered to buy him dinner, but he said he had other commitments. When we shook hands, he held on to mine. "I hope," he said, "that you won't take me wrong. I'm not a pessimist. I know in the end we will win. We have to. Islam is a false religion, lacks a conscience, a soul. Imagine if your equivalent to Christ lopped people's heads off. What kind of a religion is that?" Over dinner alone at the Phoenician, I thought about that last comment. My time in Beirut convinced me that a clash in cultures, especially around religion, was the overt cause of many of the problems in the Middle East, although not necessarily the root cause. I knew that the Crusades had been organized by the Church as a war against what it called the satanic forces of Islam. However, I had also read that Europe, suffering from strife, high unemployment, and the plague, was ripe for rebellion, and that the aristocracy used the Crusades to refocus that anger and conquer new lands. I was struck by the contrast between Smiley's view of Islam and what I had heard in Indonesia just a few months earlier. Living in the West Javanese mountain city of Bandung, I befriended a young man whose mother managed a guest house where I and the rest of the main team were staying. As described in my book, Confessions, Rossi introduced me to a number of his university friends. One night they accompanied me to a dalang, a traditional Javanese puppet show. A puppet of Richard Nixon and another I took to be Henry Kissinger stood next to a map of the Middle and Far East. Each of the countries hung from a hook over its respective position. Nixon lifted countries off their hooks and thrust them into his mouth. Every time he picked up a Middle Eastern country, he tasted it and shouted something that was translated as, "Bitter! Rubbish! We don't need any more of this!" Then he tossed it into a bucket held by Henry Kissinger. After the show, the students and I retired to a local coffee house. They explained to me that in the opinion of many Indonesians, the United States was waging an anti-Islamic war. They informed me that, back in the 50s, the British historian Arnold Toynbee had predicted that the real war in the next century would not be between communists and capitalists, but between Christians and Muslims. A young English major at the university patiently described their view. "The West," she said, "especially its leader, the U.S., is determined to take control of all the world, to become the greatest empire in history. It has already gotten very close to succeeding. The Soviet Union currently stands in its way, but the Soviets will not endure. They have no religion, no faith, no substance behind their ideology. History demonstrates that faith, soul, a belief in higher powers is essential. We Muslims have it. We have it more than anyone else in the world, even more than the Christians. So we wait. We grow strong." She looked me in the eyes. "Stop being so greedy and so selfish. Realize that there is more to the world than your big houses and fancy stores. People are starving, and you worry about oil for your cars. Babies are dying of thirst, and you search the fashion pages for the latest styles. Nations like ours are drowning in poverty, but your people don't even hear our cries for help. You shut your ears to the voices of those who try to tell you these things. You label them radicals or communists. You must open your hearts to the poor and downtrodden, instead of driving them further into poverty and servitude. There's not much time left. If you don't change, you're doomed." Recalling that evening and my more recent day with Smiley,
I wondered if there was any hope for a world where religion had become the basis for exploitation. How could so many people be taught to look at religion so differently? How could the messages of Muhammad and Christ both be used to justify war? The implications of those questions continued to haunt me. That first visit to the Middle East gave me a new perspective on religion's importance in international politics. It was in Egypt, however, that I personally experienced the power of religion as an agent of hatred. Chapter 33. U.S. Aid Speaks. The pyramids of Egypt symbolize the role that country must play if we're to win the hearts and minds of the Arabs. Maine's enigmatic octogenarian chairman and CEO, Mac Hall, told a group of us who had assembled for lunch at the posh Engineers Club on the top floor of the Prudential Tower, Boston's tallest building and the home of Maine's executive offices. Egypt will form the base, large and firm. Then we will pile them up, one country after the next. It was 1974, a pivotal moment in Egypt's long history. Maine and our corporatocracy clients were determined to take advantage of this opportunity. A door opened when we won a contract to complete a major study in Alexandria. A U.S. aid officer had flown up from Washington for a luncheon briefing on the country's struggles and the goals of our work there. His cropped hair, immaculately trimmed mustache, starched shirt, gray suit, blue necktie, accentuated with a slash of red, and two lapel pins, one of the U.S. flag, the other a black hand clasping a white one, accentuated his role as a government representative, one of the new breed of colonizer posing as altruist. He sat very stiffly at the table, and as he talked, frequently shot deferential glances at Mac Hall. I realized that he came to us in several guises, that of an expert on Egypt, the man who would evaluate our study and approve payment of our fees, and also as a potential employee, a Washington bureaucrat always on the lookout for a better job or lucrative retirement consultancy. While he described his experiences in the Middle East, he wove Egypt's history into his monologue, emphasizing that centuries of foreign domination had laid the foundation for post-World War II events. "The Muslim Brotherhood," he said, spitting out the words as though they stung his tongue, "became very influential. They demanded that Egypt break off ties with Europe. The Brethren joined forces with the Society of Free Officers, a revolutionary group of Egyptian army brass, to oppose King Farouk, hated because he was an Albanian whose family gained prominence in Egypt under the Ottoman Empire and was later supported by the British and us. This coalition toppled Farouk, much to our chagrin. Well, you know who came next. Lieutenant Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser was sworn in as premier in 1954 and then president in 1956. In what the U.S. aid man described as a reckless gamble, Nasser declared his independence from the Western powers. He negotiated deals to buy Soviet weapons. Of course, we and the Brits withdrew our offers to build a dam at Aswan. It infuriated Nasser, so he nationalized the Suez Canal. Israel responded in 1956 by invading the Sinai Peninsula. You can bet we had something to do with that, but not officially. England and France both claimed the canal as essential to their security. They bombed Egyptian positions and sent in their armies. The canal was shut down. The U.S. aid man frowned. We simply couldn't tolerate that. The world clamored for U.S. goods and Middle Eastern oil. The long haul around Africa was way too costly. A bunch of corporate executives visited the White House. Ike heard them. The general took command. He grinned at Hall. A ceasefire was proclaimed in November 1956, and a UN peacekeeping force arrived to patrol the borders between Egypt and Israel. He paused to take a sip of water and, I supposed,
allow the rest of us to ponder the levity of his words.
In essence, he continued, Uncle Sam forced Israel, Britain, and France to pull out. Only a little over a year earlier, we'd returned sanity to Iran by deposing that commie Mossadegh and reinstating our friend the Shah. Now we showed the Arabs we would stand behind them in Egypt. Washington became the undisputed dominant power in the region.
The review that afternoon in a private club atop the Prudential Tower strengthened my growing cynicism, as well as my desire to enjoy the fruits accruing to this dominant power I called home. As I listened, it seemed evident that the triumphs in Iran and Egypt had established the supremacy of the corporatocracy, and that this government employee was paid to brag about it. Those corporate executives, who just happened to control the defense industry along with most of the rest of the American economy, had forced the President of the United States to acquiesce to their demands. Now, less than two decades later, a government agency was spinning its revised view of history into its official talks. I was amazed at the cunning of these people, and I felt both privileged and guilty to be included in this scheme for building what I was coming to understand was nothing less than the world's first secret empire. I glanced out the window at the Charles River far below. Across it in the distance, the sun reflected off the ivy-laced buildings of Harvard, which had undoubtedly educated at least several of those executives who visited the White House that day. I recalled Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex. It seemed extremely ironic that a career military officer and supreme commander of Allied forces during World War II was the first to publicly expose the existence of what today we refer to as the corporatocracy. He had watched those executives gain influence over U.S. foreign policy during the Korean War. He had witnessed how they manipulated the press and Congress and employed the communist threat as a justification for whittling away at civil liberties. He had stood by as they sold technologies to the military for delivering missile-guided nuclear warheads to distant lands. But in Egypt, during the Suez Crisis, he must have begun to truly fear the pact between the government, military, and corporations. He had acquiesced, yes, but deep inside, he must have seethed. A man trained to discipline himself, he had, I guessed, bided his time, waiting until his term as president was over. Then, he dropped his own bomb. Like many good anti-Vietnam War protesters in the late 1960s, I had hung a framed copy of Ike's January 17, 1961 address, his farewell speech, over my desk. Eisenhower described his country as one whose economy had been built on peaceful endeavors. Until the latest of our world conflicts, he said, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. Then he issued a warning. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Nasser was a hothead. The U.S. aid officer's voice brought my attention back to the engineers' club. He was a hothead who thought he could outsmart us, so he foolishly continued to court the Soviet Union. He got them to build the Aswan High Dam. You can only imagine how your friend, he turned to Mac Hall, Mr. Bechtel felt about that. Hal chortled. Not just Bechtel, the whole lot of us, everyone in the engineering business. Right. But Bechtel had the connections, the president's ear. Hall glanced around the table.
Very good at kissing ass.
This brought laughter. The U.S. aid man took another sip of water before continuing. Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood was back in play. They felt betrayed by Nasser's partnership with atheistic communists and his refusal to create an Islamic government. They claimed all this ran counter to an agreement they made when they joined forces with the Society of Free Officers to overthrow Farouk. They wanted their president to adopt the Quran as the basis for their constitution. When he refused, they sent in one of their hit teams to assassinate him. But they botched the job and it backfired. Nasser's popularity grew. He banned the Brotherhood, sentenced 4,000 of its members to prison camps, and had the ringleaders executed. Those who escaped went underground. Some attempted to infiltrate labor unions, schools, and even the military. Many left the country, heading for Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Syria, and, as you know, Kuwait, where you guys have a major electrification project, right? He nodded at Hall. Well, over the years, they've evolved into one of the most influential pro-Islamic forces in the world. Their goal is to drive us, everyone from the West, all the Christian cultures, out of the Middle East, overthrow secular leaders like those in Egypt and Iran, and replace them with mullahs. I was tempted to ask him about the rumors I had heard that, despite their stated goals and because they opposed communism, the Brethren received CIA funding and training. But I knew that he could only answer such a question one way, and that asking it might cost me dearly, especially under these circumstances. Any questions? He glanced around. Just about done. The '60s were tumultuous for Egypt. Nasser instituted economic reforms, Marxism, including a mandate that the government own at least 51% of all Egyptian businesses. What a disaster. All it did was manage to piss us off more. The UN peacekeeping force remained until 1967. Sporadic fighting occurred between Egyptian and Israeli forces until 1970, and the canal continues to be closed to shipping to this day. Nasser died less than 4 years ago in 1970. Vice President Anwar Sadat took over. We worked diligently to bring Sadat around to our side. Believe me, I was there. At first, he resisted. He made a big deal out of concluding a treaty with the Soviets that Nasser began. He seemed to enjoy thumbing his nose at us. But we ignored the insults and hung in there. It worked. Sadat did an about-face. He expelled the Soviets in 72. He sighed. Then he blew it again. He sent troops across the Suez Canal and attacked Israeli positions in the Sinai. Simultaneously, Syria invaded Israel along the Golan Heights. Israel drove back their attackers and, you know the rest, the Yom Kippur War ended in a ceasefire on October 24, 1973. Now, Sadat's feverishly courting us again, trying to make amends. Negotiating disengagement accords with Israel, actively encouraging foreign investment, and requesting U.S. and World Bank aid. The window of opportunity has opened. He drained his water. Mr. Hall, I very much agree with your statement. He glanced down at a paper on the table next to his plate. The pyramids of Egypt symbolize the role that country must play if we're to win the hearts and minds of the Arabs. Egypt will form the base, large and firm. Then we will pile them up, one country after the next. He leaned toward Hall, a subtle but obvious bow of respect. Sir, I'd like to commend you for that. A brilliant evaluation. It totally reflects the reality of where we stand today.